Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa's Supreme Court has been busy hearing and deciding cases, so this hour we're going to look to have some analysis of those rulings and what they might mean for the states and possibly for you. Joining us to do that, two legal scholars, Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa. She is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor and Bauma Fellow in Law at the University of Iowa. Emily Hughes, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tony Goggin is with us in our Des Moines studio, law professor at Drake University Law School. Tony, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Ben.
Let's start off with something, Tony, I hope you can sort of tell us a little bit about. It's been in our news for the last couple of hours, in our legislative news for sure. This has to do with unions here in Iowa, and unions do represent tens of thousands of Iowa teachers, other city, county, state officials, school workers. And if we think back to the 2017 legislative session, we had a law limiting public worker unions' rights that was passed in February of 2017. Pick up the story there. Tell us where the origins of this case that was recently decided, I think in May, by the Iowa Supreme Court, how it started.
Absolutely, Ben. As you said, in 2017, the legislature amended the law, which precisely was the Public Employment Relations Act, for the purpose of reducing the influence of public sector unions. To that end, the legislative amendments ended payroll deductions for union dues, and most importantly, they also narrowed the scope of mandatory collective bargaining topics for most public employees. But here's really the flashpoint of the legal dispute. The law exempted from its application police officers, firefighters, and other public safety employees. And to do that, the law expressly stated that it did not apply to unions comprised of at least 30% public safety employees. Accordingly, in response, a public employee union and its members filed suit alleging that the legislative amendments violated the Equal Protection Clause of the state constitution because they distinguished between, according to the plaintiffs, the law distinguished between different categories of public sector employees in an arbitrary and unreasonable way. Now, the union lost in district court, and then, as you said, Ben, last month, the state Supreme Court ruled against the union as well. A 4-3 majority of the court held that the Constitution permits the legislature to exempt public safety employees from these new limits on public sector unions. And critically, the state Supreme Court held that the 30% threshold complied with the Constitution. The opinion was written by Justice Waterman, and what he based his ruling on was the fact that in the view of the majority of the court, the legislature could reasonably conclude that the goal of keeping labor peace with public safety unions combined with the greater risks faced by emergency first responders justified distinguishing between public safety employees. And in the view of the majority, the 30% threshold complied with the Constitution because it achieved the legislature's goals in a way that, in the court's view, really was not subject to second-guessing. What should the line have been, 20% or 40% or 50%? Justice Waterman ultimately concluded that was something best left to the legislature. So this was a major victory for the legislature.
Tony, go a little bit more into how the plaintiffs who eventually lost here, how they said that it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Iowa Constitution. Let's say I am in a public union and I might be a school worker, I might be a teacher. I'm not in a union because there are lots of different public unions, right?
Right.
And so I happen to be in a union that has that is predominantly school teachers, for instance. So that is one of them that is not exempted here.
That's right. And the critical issue is the fact that there are other non-public safety, public sector employees who are going to get, unlike the teachers, are going to get special treatment under the law based on the fact that they just happen to be in a bargaining unit with at least 30% public safety employees.
Oh.
So they basically get to tag along with the police officers or firefighters or other public safety employees who happen to be in their bargaining unit. And for the dissenters, Chief Justice Kady and Justice Apple in their dissents, they really focused on that point, and they argued that this was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause because you've got very similar employees, mm-hmm. non-public safety employees, who are being treated differently just because of the particular bargaining unit they ended up in. But a majority of the court was unpersuaded. And really, Justice Waterman's opinion came down to one sentence where he said that, quote, our role is not to decide whether constitutional our role is to decide whether constitutional lines are crossed, not to sit as a super legislature rethinking policy choices of the elected branches. And he even went on to say that the plaintiffs should look to the ballot box and the elected branches to change this law if they don't like it. Mm. There's no constitutional violation here by drawing this 30% threshold in the view of the majority.
Okay, so the court really wasn't concerned with the implications of this change.
Is with regard to the impact on in the disparate impact on non-public safety employees. But right, and I see, Ben, with regard to what the actual impact will be from a policy standpoint, mm-hmm. that's right. The court was just viewing this from the constitutional perspective of the equal protection issue. And in addition, the unions argued that their freedom of association was violated by this law. Such as as a consequence of the elimination of mandatory deduction of union fees and things like that. But the majority also didn't buy that argument. The majority said, look, the unions can still associate with whoever they want to. It's just this law now puts certain limits on what's mandatory in the collective bargaining process.
Mm-hmm. If we think back to February 2017, when this law was passed, the origin of this, the seed of this eventual case before the Iowa Supreme Court, in February 2017, the Republicans had just a few weeks earlier, in November of 2016, gained control of both houses of the legislature for the first time in a long time, and then they went right to work. The Democrats cried foul over this particular move. There were protests at the State House with the debates going on here. So has this law, Tony, been in effect the whole time while the Iowa Supreme Court has been deciding?
The district court rejected the initial challenge. So I believe, like for schools, I'm not sure of this, but I think the 2018-19 school year operated under the new rules. I could be wrong about that. In any case, certainly the new rules are in application today. Wisconsin went through this whole process in 2011. And so in many ways, Iowa is following on the heels of this neighboring state. And in Wisconsin, the battle was really dragged out for quite a long period through the past decade, whereas a two-year beginning and end to this legal fight here in Iowa is relatively quick compared to what our neighbors in Wisconsin experienced.
Mm-hmm. This was a narrow ruling, 4-3. It doesn't get any narrower than that here in Iowa.
That's exactly right. It was a very close very close call.
Tony Goggin is with us, law professor at Drake University Law School. Also, Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa on the faculty of the law school there as well. If you've just joined us, we're going through recent Iowa Supreme Court cases. Most of the decisions decided in May, I think perhaps all of them. Let's go to one that gets us outside. It's a beautiful day. Why not, Emily? we've had a couple of windy days. I was bike riding yesterday. I was reminded of our great wind power here in the state. If we go back to a recent Iowa Supreme Court decision, they rejected a lawsuit by landowners to block a proposed wind farm in the northwest part of the state. Tell us that story. How did this case get started?
That's right. They rejected the idea of blocking the wind farm. And let me start back with how the wind farm was built. In July of 2015, a development manager for a renewable energy company approached basically the Planning and Zoning Commission and asked about the zoning ordinances for wind turbines. And this was in Palo Alto County, and they looked at their ordinance and they realized they hadn't updated it for quite a while. And so they decided to go about updating their ordinance about what should we do about regulating wind turbines. So their county attorney started the process of drafting and updating that ordinance. And really what this case is about is the process that planning and zoning commissions use to kind of keep abreast of new changes like renewable energy and like wind turbines. So they basically redrafted, updated, have a new ordinance in place, and the landowners whose property was going to be affected by the 170 turbines that were going to be built brought the suit.
Mm-hmm. And they brought the suit, and their arguments were, what did they say?
Well, basically, they were arguing that the process that was used to update the ordinance was not a good process. And let me sort of talk about a couple of the things that they were complaining about. One of them was they said that basically the county attorney and the zoning commission had deferred too much to MidAmerican Energy and to the renewable energy company that wanted the ordinance, mm-hmm. you know, that had asked about the ordinance in the first place. For example, let me give you a couple ideas. One was that the renewable energy company asked that the ordinance be 2,640 foot setback from houses. So, you know, you couldn't build a turbine closer than 2,600 feet from permanent residential dwellings.
That's what the energy company said.
Well, so that's what the ordinance originally said. Mm. And the energy companies came in and said, actually, we think it would, you know, they provided comments during the regular process of considering new changes to an ordinance. And they said that a better distance would be 1,000 to 1,320 feet.
So right? Maybe roughly half.
Roughly half. In the end, the zoning commission didn't adopt what the energy companies wanted, but they also did change it. So they changed it from 2,600 feet to a setback of 1,500 feet. So basically, a wind turbine can't be built in Palo Alto County closer than 1,500 feet to a permanent residential house. So that was one thing. Another was the idea of the shadow that a wind turbine casts mm-hmm. on permanent residential houses. And the energy company wanted up to 50 hours of a shadow looking at that per year. And the ordinance was written for 30. And so the landowners were complaining and saying, you should have done more than you did. But in fact, the zoning commission did not do the full 50 that the energy companies wanted.
Okay, so in short, in both of these cases, when the siting of the actually wind turbine, the proximity of it to a house, and also this shadow, we see that the energy company had some influence. It didn't get all of its wishes, but it seemed to be that Palo Alto County in northwest Iowa was sort of trying to find a happy medium or a compromise there.
Exactly. So again, it's all about kind of the process they used to update their ordinance. And they took into consideration some of the comments and some of the things that the energy company advised, but they didn't take everything and they didn't do everything that the energy company wanted.
And so what was this lawsuit about? Just that the process was wrong. And what did it violate, did they say? What was the legal argument that they were making before the Iowa Supreme Court?
So the legal argument was that the district court had granted summary judgment, basically sustaining the action of the County Board of Supervisors. And what that means is that the landowners don't get their day in court, right? That summary judgment means you don't have a case, you can't go forward on this.
Mm, okay.
So in deciding the opinion, some of the other things that the court noted, they went through really carefully. Well, let's think about what the Zoning Commission did consider when it was changing the ordinance. And it went through, for example, the DNR and a state archaeologist had proposed that maybe some other things be written into the ordinance, like some pre-construction surveys, maybe for some unmarked graves or some areas where there were birds and bats. And that was rejected by the Zoning Commission. But the court said, you know, they listened to both sides and they decided to reject it. And that's an okay part of the process.
Mm-hmm. So when in making this decision, the Iowa Supreme Court in this case at the Palo Alto County, so what are the implications now for Iowa's other 98 counties? Is this binding? Will these utilities in these counties then be paying close attention to this?
So this was one ordinance out of one county, and certainly other counties who are looking to update their ordinances might look to Palo Alto, but there's nothing about this ordinance that has to be adopted in other counties. This is just one county and one zoning commission.
Okay, Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa Law School telling us about a recent Iowa Supreme Court ruling that involved wind farms. Before the break, Tony, I think we have 6 or 7 minutes. Let's keep us outdoors, well, actually underground, I think, the pipeline. We had more than a year after the oil began to flow under Iowa fields in the Dakota Access Pipeline. That is something that's been out of our news for a little while. We remember this is a land... this is a lawsuit where we had some landowners, also sort of strange bedfellows situation, landowners getting together with those more concerned about the environment. Tell us about the case that was recently decided over this Dakota Access Pipeline.
Yes, Ben. This case arose from this $4 billion pipeline, which has really been national news as well as Iowa news over the last couple of years. And as the Iowa Supreme Court noted in its opinion, which was a ruling in favor of the pipeline company and the Iowa Utilities Board, North Dakota is the second leading oil-producing state in the United States, but the country's oil refining capacity is located many hundreds of miles away, with most of our largest oil refineries in Texas and Louisiana. So oil producers in North Dakota were looking for a way to move crude oil through an underground pipeline from North Dakota to Illinois, where the oil could then connect with this pre-existing oil transportation network in the United States. But of course, if you look on a map, you'll see Iowa is between Illinois and the Dakotas. And so the Dakota Access Corporation wanted to build a pipeline through Iowa in a pipeline that would underground pipeline that would ultimately affect 18 counties. And in response, as you said, Ben, we ended up with this lawsuit. The main argument that the landowners and the Sierra Club brought, among others, was that the pipeline did not serve the public convenience and necessity as required by state statutes and did not meet the constitutional definition of public use. However, a majority of the Iowa Supreme Court, in a ruling handed down just 10 days ago, handed a huge victory to the Utilities Board and the Dakota Access Corporation. Writing for the majority, Justice Mansfield concluded that the pipeline did meet statutory and constitutional requirements. He noted that although the pipeline passes through the state without taking on or letting off oil, it's really, we're just a go-between, he said that it will result in the cheaper and safer transportation of oil and thus will lead to lower prices for petroleum products around the country, which will benefit 3 million Iowans. Mm-hmm. And like Justice Waterman, interestingly, in the public sector unions case, Justice Mansfield emphasized that it's not the job of the state Supreme Court to promulgate public policy, but rather to simply confine itself to the legal issues. One of the key quotes in his opinion was that policymaking is not our function, and as a legal matter, we are satisfied that the Dakota Access Pipeline meets the characteristics of a public use under the Iowa and U.S. constitutions. In contrast, the dissenting justices argued that the use of eminent domain for the pipeline did not meet the requirements of the state constitution because the Iowa public cannot use the pipeline and it does not derive a direct benefit from it. Ooh, the newest justice, Justice McDonald, actually dissented from the opinion on grounds that the Dakota Access Pipeline is already a done deal. It's finished and has been in operation for a long time. And so he argued that the whole case was moot. In any case, this was certainly a very important victory for the Utilities Board and one that really reflects the success that oil producers have had around the country in securing legal victories.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, pardon the pun here, if this breaks new ground because we have eminent domain laws I mean, it's a clear-cut case. If you are some kind of government entity and you want to build a government structure or some kind of infrastructure that you need for your county or your state government, right, Tony? And it's something that's paid for by taxpayers' dollars. But here we have a private company, an oil company, that is paying for it, investing in it, building it. Is that the new thing here? Was that part of what was argued over?
It was. And certainly that's what the dissenters focused on, the idea that this is an out-of-state private corporation that's benefiting from the use of eminent domain. But the majority, which in the opinion, the majority was careful to say that it is very concerned about the excessive and aggressive and improper use of eminent domain. But the majority ultimately concluded that this is not one of those cases because there is such a clear impact on petroleum users around the country, and that includes every single one of us. Mm-hmm. And the reality is you've got to get the petroleum in North Dakota moved to the nation's refining capacity, and that's something that private corporations do. We don't have state-run oil companies in the United States. And so although it is a private corporation that benefits in the immediate term, I think from the majority's point of view, this is a pretty clear-cut case of a benefit to the public in the long run.
Mm-hmm. We have just a minute or two before we go to break, Tony. But as I mentioned here, landowners linking arms with the environmental groups, for instance, the Iowa chapter of the Sierra Club, losing in this case. And a lot of their arguments, at least from a news gathering perspective, involved potential pipeline leaks and the spoilage that it could have there. Emily, is that a point that you wanted to speak to or something else?
Well, actually, I was just going to say there's a wind turbine issue in the case as well. So, but I'll let you.
Well, we've got to go to break in a minute. Tony, perhaps after the break we can talk about the turbine aspect. But Tony, were those environmental concerns any concern of our justices on the Iowa Supreme Court?
Well, again, this is a case that's ultimately determined by what the meaning of public use is and whether this satisfied statutory requirements. And I think the majority would say that many of these public policy concerns that are discussed in the media with regard to the pipeline are something that is really in the jurisdiction of the state legislature. Mm-hmm. And that if voters are concerned about it, they can vote for legislators who are going to impose more stringent environmental regulations on the pipelines and on oil producers. But that's not something that was within the jurisdiction of the court itself.
Okay. Tony Goggin is with us. He'll be with us in the second half hour of Drake University Law School, as will Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa Law School. We're talking about recent cases decided by the Iowa Supreme Court. When we come back, we'll have Emily tell us a little bit about three cases that where the Iowa court is trying to clarify methods for assessing whether a jury is representative to its community. Three cases kind of bundled together. We'll ask Emily why that is and how the court decided when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the program, I want to talk about first responders and the mental health challenges they face at work. I'll talk with an Iowa police officer tomorrow, also a firefighter, about traumatic events in their line of work, as well as the negative mental health symptoms that can occur. Also, we'll talk about, maybe you didn't know this, I didn't know this, that recruiting for law enforcement, whatever level, state level, county level, federal level, recruiting for law enforcement has become difficult. We'll find out why that is and what law enforcement is doing to raise the number of recruits. Today, we're talking about recent cases before the Iowa Supreme Court, cases decided before the Supreme Court to get some analysis about their impact in the legal world, but more importantly for us, because most of us are not legal scholars or lawyers, attorneys, what it means for us, everyday people operating within the structure of our laws that are constantly being refined and also interpreted by our courts. Here to do that is Emily Hughes, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, also professor and Bauma Fellow in Law at the University of Iowa, Tony Goggin, law professor at Drake University Law School in Des Moines. Well, let's go to a series of cases the High Court tackled here, the state's High Court. Emily, this has to do with a representative jury. And when we think about being tried by a jury of our peers, representative is a big deal there. We want to, like, if we want to have, what, a male-female balance and or aim for that and what, and have ethnically that makeup, so it is really peer-like.
That's right. And the word that the court uses is a fair cross-section of the community. And so the idea is you look at a community and you think about what are the distinctive groups in that community, and then the jury that's trying a case, is that representing the distinctive groups in the community at a sort of at approximately the same percentage that those groups appear in the community?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this case, the Iowa Supreme Court took, what, three cases together? They had some commonality that they wanted to decide or refine.
That's right. The three cases, Veal, Lilly, and Williams are the three. They all talk about this fair cross-section of the community. They're all about jury selection. How do we choose who we put on juries? And some of the behind-the-scenes things that happen with jury selection, even before jurors show up to court, what's happening in terms of how we're choosing, which jurors get, you know, which potential jurors are even sent notices to come to court.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us about these cases, a little bit more about each of them and how the court tackled it.
Great. We'll start with Veal. And all of the cases were decided on May 24th, and all three cases that I'm going to talk about were by Justice Mansfield. So he was very busy between these three cases. So Veal, the first case, is, the charges, they're all criminal cases, and Veal was charged with two murders and an attempted murder. Basically, the murders happened inside of a home, and there was literally a bloody footprints and a blood trail leading from the house to where Veal was found. And then along the way, along the trail, police found different items that Veal had left while he was running from police. So they found a hat, a cell phone, a green jacket, a shirt, and a folding knife. So that's kind of the case. And the issues that the court was thinking about was, how was Veal's jury picked? There were 153 people who were responding to the, you know, the notices to appear for jury duty, and five of them were African American. Veal himself is African American, and the court was looking at how is that an okay cross section of the community?
When five out of 150.
Five out of about 150, exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's about about 3%, 3.27%. And so they have to look also at, well, what are the percentage, you know, what's the percentage of African Americans living in the community? And that percentage is 4.6%. So you get into a lot of statistics with these cases, statistics and percentages, because they're looking at the number of people that respond to jury summons, the number of people that are living in the community, and whether the courts can do a better job being more representative, bringing more diverse people from different kinds of distinct groups into the courthouse.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Emily, there are established methods for how the prosecution and the defense attorneys can eliminate potential jurors, right?
Exactly.
So if you were on the prosecution side here, you would probably, without knowing anything about them, just look at knowing only their skin color, you might want to eliminate some potential jurors that are not white.
Exactly. So the first cut of this fair cross-section of the community is just who's even coming. And then when we have a pool of people, the pool is kind of the group that's in the courthouse, then the prosecutors and the defense attorneys get to start asking questions to the juries, the jury selection process.
Mm-hmm.
And then that turns in the next sort of line of issues, which is, what kinds of questions are they asking? Who is the judge letting go? That's called a challenge for cause. Like, you get to go home because we don't think this is the right jury for you to serve on. For
something in your answer told us that you're not the one.
Exactly. So, for example, if you had a relative who was prosecuted by that same prosecutor, then that might be, a reason that you might not want to sit on that jury.
You might be prejudiced, yeah.
Right. So there are challenges for cause, which is challenges that the judge says you get to go home. And then there are also peremptory challenges, which means the judge did not tell the juror that they can go home, but the prosecutor or the defense attorney get a certain number of those, and it depends on the level of case how many they get. But they get to send certain people home if they think that this isn't the right jury for that person to serve on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So okay. We don't have time to go into depth with the other cases, but give us sort of what happened here, what the high court decided with these three cases, the outcome here.
Right. So the outcome is that the court was really trying to give guidance about how every courthouse across the state should determine those pools of jurors. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of what constitute a fair cross-section, they gave guidance about how prosecutors and defense attorneys should be arguing that issue. All three of the cases that I talked about, Veal, Lilly, and Williams, the first was a murder case, the second an armed robbery, and the third was another murder case. They all got remanded, which means they're going back down to the trial courts. Now, that doesn't mean that they necessarily get a new trial. What it means is the Supreme Court said, we want more information. We want the trial courts to have more, an opportunity to hear more about how those initial jurors were picked.
Mm-hmm. And so going forward, putting these three cases aside, courts will no longer be able to use some methods. Their methods of selecting juries, narrowing jurors into a pool that they can use is now been more defined for future courts all over Iowa.
Yeah, it's not that they can't use the method. It's that the method that they're using, we have more understanding about what that should look like.
I see.
And I'll just add, too, that there were some really important things that some of the justices said in concurrences and dissents about what other changes what big changes we should consider making to Iowa's jury selection system. But we have not made those big changes yet.
Okay. If you just joined us, we're talking about Iowa Supreme Court rulings, recent ones. Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa, Tony Goggin of Drake University with us as well. Tony, I want to turn to you because, this filled a lot of our legislative day discussion recently. There's a new process. This came very late in the 2018 legislative session and became law, passed by the Republican-controlled legislature here in Iowa, a new process for Iowa's judicial nominating system. So this affects not only justices and the Iowa Supreme Court, or is it only that court, or also district courts?
This just affects the appellate court, so
the
Court of Appeals judges and the state Supreme Court justices.
Okay, so last month we had a lawsuit filed by a Cedar Rapids lawyer, also Democrats. Well, what are they saying here?
That's right, Ben. So the change that was made this spring by the legislature was to change the makeup of the nominating commission. So for the past 57 years here in Iowa, we've had a 17-member nominating commission whose job it is to select three candidates from a pool of applicants for judicial positions, and then the governor chooses from among the candidates that the commission has selected. That basic system is unchanged by the law, except with regard to the 17th member of the commission. Under the old system, the senior justice on the Iowa Supreme Court served as the 17th member. And under the new system, the Supreme Court justice has been taken off the commission and replaced with a member selected by the governor. So what that means is 9 of the 17 members are selected by the governor, subject to Senate confirmation, and 8 members are made up of members of the Iowa State Bar. So that's a subtle change, but it's an important change because it gives the governor a tie-breaking vote, or at least members selected by the governor have a tie-breaking vote when it comes to deciding who gets into that final group of candidates that the governor will select from. What the lawsuit alleges is that the bill that was enacted violated the state constitution in a couple of ways. One, they argue that The bill included unrelated matters, and that's a violation of the constitutional prohibition on log rolling. And they also argued that the law violated the prohibition on vague or deceptive titles. In both cases, the Constitution directs that legislation should be clear what its contents are and that the title should be descriptive. And the challengers here say, hey, that wasn't the case with this bill. And then the additional argument the challengers are making is that it violates the separation of powers, because in this bill, the legislature is telling the Supreme Court that it needs to elect a chief justice every 2 years, as opposed to letting the justices themselves decide the process. And so this lawsuit was brought by 8 Democratic legislators, as well as this attorney in Cedar Rapids, who's a former legislator. And then just recently, an outgoing member of the commission itself has joined the lawsuit. So this is something that will be making its way through the courts.
Mm-hmm. And the timeline for that, months, years?
Oh, I think this will probably be resolved pretty quickly, because I don't think the challenge is likely to be successful. I think the first problem they're going to have is just the fact that this was one of the most hotly debated issues in the state for the last several months. It received extensive media coverage. Mm-hmm. It led to a very acrimonious debate in the state legislature. I don't think any member of the legislature had any doubt about the contents of the bill. They knew what they were voting for. And the separation of powers argument is a really interesting one, but it's something that I suspect that the courts may be deferential to as well, because it's not directing any particular outcome, the bill, with regard to who wins the Chief Justice vote, but rather just requires that there actually be a vote every 2 years.
Tony, in your explanation there, I'm interested to see why certainly among elected officials, the Democrats were saying this will make it the whole process much more partisan, but that was not in the legal world part of the argument, it seems.
That's right. This is really simply an issue of whether or not the process for getting this bill enacted complied with the Constitution, and also whether or not this is the legislature getting too deeply involved in the internal workings of the Supreme Court. I would suspect if the plaintiffs were to have success, I think it might come on that second issue as opposed to the first, for this simple reason, which is, if, as you know, Ben, if you look at legislation that gets passed in Des Moines or in Washington, D.C., these bills are huge. It's very hard for titles to capture everything that's going on in them. And this could potentially be a precedent that would cause lots of, if we were to say that this wasn't transparent enough, this process, I think that's a precedent that could pose a lot of, it could lead to a lot of unintended consequences down the road. So I don't think that part of the argument's likely to succeed. But I am curious to see if the plaintiffs find any traction on the idea that the Supreme Court should be left to itself to decide when they and how often they select their Chief Justice.
A couple of other things quickly to touch on before we say goodbye for this hour, Tony Gawkin and Emily Hughes. Arthur McGivern, he's the man who served longer than any other Chief Justice of Iowa Supreme Court, died a little more than a week ago. He was 90 years old, a native of Ottumwa. Before pursuing a career in law, he served 2 tours of duty in the U.S. Army. He was named to be a district court judge in 1965, joined the High Court in Iowa in 78, was its Chief Justice from 87 until his retirement in 2000. Briefly, Emily, let me start with you. Your thoughts on Arthur McGivern? It's been a while since he's been, of course, Chief Justice.
It has been a while, but he has a very strong reputation that continues. My understanding, and I did not know him, but my understanding is that he had a reputation as a very patient and humble Chief Justice. I'd also note that he was a double Hawkeye, too, graduating from the University of Iowa Law School.
Both degrees.
That's
yeah,
right.
Undergraduate and his legal credentials there. Tony, your thoughts?
Yeah, oh, I agree with Emily, Ben. Certainly, although I also did not know the Chief Justice, his reputation was as an unusually warm, courteous, humble, patient person. Apparently, he had a practice of not interrupting attorneys in the courtroom, which is pretty unusual for judges, especially appellate judges. And interestingly, it has been reported that he kept an office in the Wapello County Courthouse even after his elevation to the Supreme Court in 1978, which really reflected the fact that he was a person who was really grounded in where he grew up and in the concerns of ordinary people, and that he's not somebody who let his status as the Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court go to his head. And in that sense, I'd say he's really reflective of a tradition of Iowa judges that continues today. I'd say anyone who knows Mark Cady, the current Chief Justice, would say the same things about him as are being said about Chief Justice McGivern, that Chief Justice Cady is a gentleman, a warm and courteous and humble person. So I think it's certainly very sad that Chief Justice McGivern has passed away at 90, but I think it's really good that his spirit lives on in the current court and in the judiciary across the state of Iowa.
Very briefly, let's pivot to the U.S. Supreme Court to have you comment on recent news. This was big for those who watched the high court. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has given the green light to election year consideration of a Supreme Court nominee should a vacancy occur in 2020. Now, we have to recall that in 2016, McConnell, along with U.S. Senator from Iowa Chuck Grassley, who was then chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, put forth the so-called Biden rule as a rationale to avoid considering President Obama's last nominee to the high court, Merrick Garland. Grassley refusing a hearing to Merrick Garland, leaving that seat open for a full year until after President Trump took office and Justice Neil Gorsuch was confirmed. So here is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking at a Paducah Chamber of Commerce luncheon in Kentucky on May 28th, the audio courtesy of WPSD-TV in Kentucky. McConnell asked by an attendee, if a Supreme Court justice died next year, what would you do?
We'd fill it. Yeah, you know, the reason I started with the judges, as important as all these other things are that we're talking about, I mean, if you want to have a long-lasting positive impact on the country, everything else changes. You know, I remember during the tax bill, there were people agonizing over whether one part of the tax bill was permanent or not. I said, look, the only way the tax bill is permanent depends upon the next election. The next election, because people have different views about taxes in the two parties and approach it differently when they get in power. What can't be undone is a lifetime appointment to a young man or woman who believes in the quaint notion that the job of judge is to follow the law. So that's the most important thing we've done for the country, which cannot be undone.
Okay, Tony, let me start with you as a brief comment on our way out. I didn't hear any justification, any reason to say that the Biden rule doesn't apply here. Did you, Tony?
And no, Ben, I think this is just about politics and power. I think there are two driving factors here. The first is we are living through the most intense period of partisan and ideological polarization that the United States has experienced in over 100 years. And secondly, the courts, the judiciary, both the state and federal levels, is more important today than arguably it has been in any time in the last several generations. And so I think Senator McConnell and Senator Grassley are really approaching this as an ends justifies the means situation. And so I would expect that if Clarence Thomas retires either this summer or next summer, you will certainly see a full-on political war to get the most conservative justice appointed. And I would hasten to add that I think we're likely, if Democrats win the White House in 2020 and take the Senate back, I think it's quite likely the Democrats will also be very aggressive in attempting to get the most progressive or liberal justice on the court. I think this is just something we're going to be experiencing for years to come as a result of the polarization in our society.
Mm-hmm. I think to throw in here, according to the reports, maybe you've heard different ones, but Senator Grassley said just last month, May of 2018, May, a little over a year ago on Iowa Press, that he would follow the Biden rule for 2020 if there was a vacancy on the court. I don't know if he said anything since then, but I know he did say that on Iowa Press. We have just a few seconds left. Emily, your thoughts on this interesting quote from Mitch McConnell that to greenlight an election year consideration of a Supreme Court nominee should there be a vacancy in 2020?
Well, a part of what he said was that talked about the long-lasting impact of justices, and that is exactly right. The opinions that we talked about today and our own Iowa Supreme Court justices and the important decisions that they're making for the state of Iowa you know, you just amplify that for the United States Supreme Court. And so the impact that this could have is really important.
Okay. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Emily Hughes, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, professor and Bauma Fellow in Law at the University of Iowa. Tony Goggin, Professor of Law at Drake University Law School. Tony and Emily, it's been a wonderful hour. Thank you for making it so accessible to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, thank you, Ben and Emily.
River to River is available as a podcast. If you want to send this to anybody, we'll have it up online in just a bit. Just subscribe to River to River using your favorite podcast app or go to iowapublicradio.org. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Also help today from Camus Leeson and Julia DiGiacomo. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.